Your money should work for you. And you got to be thinking about that from day one. Like if you're setting out to build something or you're working hard when you wake up, like wake up every day with a foundation of like, what am I working towards? How can I get to a point where my money is working for me? Again, along the way, that's a decision you have to be thinking about as a goal and a foundation to your, you know, daily endeavors in your professional career. It's not something that you just do at the finish line. Oh, once I get to a certain exit or a certain sale, then I can do this. Like it should be rooted in, at least in my opinion, into the fabric of like what's motivating you to reach a certain level of success.
When Sam Newell started his career, making his first six figures seemed like an impossible mountain to climb. Now, he's a seasoned real estate pro with over $350 million in real estate transactions so far. Sam's opening up his playbook and sharing the mic with his inner circle of experts, partners, and investors. Together, they'll dive deep into the biggest wins, losses, traumas, betrayals, and more that have made up the path to unparalleled success. It's time to get leveraged with Sam Newell.
All right, guys, I'm really excited for today's interview. Way more excited than I have been for a while. This is actually Tyson Quick, a buddy from high school. We're Idaho boys, so we get to talk about killing it in business today. We're here in Oakland, close to his home. Tyson just sold and exited a SaaS company. We want to hear about that. And but first of all, Tyson, help us understand, really take us back. How did you have the idea to build Instapage? Because that's what we're here to talk about.
Yeah.
We can get into your backstory. We can get into, you know, all that later. But I really want to know, how'd you just think of Instapage and turn it into a seven-figure, eight-figure exit?
Yeah. Thanks for having me, Sam. And like you said, it's a pleasure to be here after so many years growing up together in Idaho. You don't see a huge amount of Idaho entrepreneurs make their way to the Bay Area, but we are here. How did I start Instapage? So a number of years after I moved out of Idaho, I had moved to Hawaii, actually, started a company there. And one of the things that we ran into really quickly was profitably acquiring customers, as everyone experiences that problem. But one of the things that fascinated me is during this time, this is about 12 years ago, digital advertising was taking off, and I was really fascinated by it because you could scientifically target people that would be your ideal customers and try to, you know, mathematically acquire them for, you know, a profit. And you could reach anyone that, you know, had a digital connection or mobile device. But the problem still then was a lot of the traffic that we were getting still wasn't converting, right? And so we thought about that, and it didn't make a ton of sense because these are people who already clicked on the ad, right? They didn't just happen to end up on your website. They chose to click the ad. And so to us, that showed a lot of intent, right? So it showed us that we got to be doing something right. And we started to think about it at the time, and we decided that, you know, people were searching on Google, browsing Facebook, but at this time it was mostly Google targeting, and searching for something, clicking on the ad, expecting something, but then deciding for one reason or another that it wasn't what they were looking for. And the more we looked at it, the more we realized that we had all of these targeted ads, but we were sending everyone to the homepage of the website. So although we figured that maybe 80% of the people are not ready to buy still, but it can't be, you know, the 3% that we were getting.
Right.
So we started to look at this and we started to ask around, like, what percentage of ad traffic are other people converting? And we kept hearing this, like, you know, between 2 and 5%. 5% was even more rare. And so we realized that, you know, the average conversion rates seem to be around 3%. So we started to hypothesize that if we built as many landing pages, the term was still kind of coming to fruition at this time, as the ads themselves, and match the intent from the search to the click to the page, that we would probably get more conversions because it would be what they were looking for, what they expected. So we spent a bunch of time, again, for our former product, building these pages and running ad traffic. And what we saw was a lift of almost 400 to 500%. So we went from converting like sub 3% on a good day to like 12%.
That's huge.
And, you know, when you spend $10,000, $100,000, $1 million, a lift like that, 400% is the equivalence of spending, you know, 400 to 500% more money. And so we realized that we were onto something here. And again, you know, this sounds like common sense today, but this was like 12, 13 years ago. And at the time we decided, well, why aren't more people doing this? And it seemed to be the case that it was much easier to build an ad than it was to actually deploy a personalized page for that ad. You'd have to go to your web developer, you know, find a coder, code yourself. You know, if you had some web design skills, go modify, go update it. But marketers typically are not also the web developers. So we set out to pivot from our prior company, use the small amount of capital that we had remaining, which was about $75,000, and build a platform that would make it easy for marketers to build and deploy these themselves, and then create a subscription model around that.
You're right. It is really common nowadays. You have funnels. You have all these different people have landing pages. Realtors now.
Yeah.
I mean, when I got in real estate, you had your MLS.
Right.
And maybe your real estate agent page. Now, every listing that goes on the market has its own landing page.
Right. Its own dedicated page for its home.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So talk to me about, this is separate than shopping cart abandonment, right? They were directed to a website. Instead of to click on going to the product they're interested in, they're going to the homepage.
Yeah.
So you really found a niche in the market, which was, how do I convert these people and get them to what they're actually looking for?
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, and it even goes further than that. You know, it's one thing that at the time, most people were sending all of their traffic, regardless of the ad, to the homepage of the website and just hoping that people would, you know, browse around and find what they were looking for.
Yeah.
Kind of a catch-all. And even today, you see that quite often. But like you said, there is more people that are like, well, of course, I'm going to have a dedicated page for my, you know, this home address versus that home address. Yeah. But it actually goes further than that. And it goes into like the actual content of the ad itself. And it might be the case that, well, you know, if I have a home for sale, can I modify that listing, that page for that listing to match the context of that exact intent that person searched? So I might have searched like the best houses in Salt Lake City Hills with the pool, right? Well, how do I match that ad that says, you know, poolside, you know, house? How do I quickly modify the content, the imagery, the structure of the page to highlight that intent? So that's really where we started to focus on after the kind of low-hanging fruit was accomplished. And then into the point where up until when we sold it, where we really started to think about the combination of machine learning and personalization, right? How can we anticipate the structure of a message, a sales message that aligns with intent based on the intent derived from what we can assume what mindset that person was in when they engaged with that ad?
So basically, and again, this isn't my field, so sorry if I butcher it, but reverse engineering, you know, looking at what people are searching for, reverse engineering that into web pages,
yeah, and
then convert that into a sales process.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is definitely not normal. I mean, or at least back then. I'm just thinking of, because I'm a realtor, because I'm a real estate investor, thinking of how we do it. I mean, you have to get there and you have to click and search. And so could you track... And that, I don't know if this is a good question, but were you able to track specific shoppers based on what they're looking at and then generate, based on their searches, that new landing page? Because that's, I feel like, I don't think that's being done right now for at least real estate.
Yeah.
If someone's looking for homes with pools, that's really not done a whole lot.
Yeah.
And I feel like you could, based on searches, start, you know, everyone's being tracked now. The FBI is listening to if Facebook's listening to me right now, you know, if I say wedding rings,
right,
start saying wedding rings.
Yeah,
that's really common now. But I don't know, tell me a little bit about how you reverse engineered the info based on what they're looking for and build that into a landing page, because really I don't think a lot of people understand that. I definitely don't understand the science behind that.
Yeah, totally. So I mean, it goes from a rudimentary past into kind of a new horizons for where it's going. And I think a lot about where the future of it's going is leveraging these big breakthroughs we're seeing with AI to make what used to be, you know, impossible, or taking a team of 100 people and making it possible for an individual. And so, you know, it's everything from how do I match a keyword that was bidding for, like on Google per se, and match that keyword with the landing page. So it might be as rudimentary as like someone searched this specific thing and I matched a URL that was a modification of another page to send that person who searched for that specific keyword to that page. But where things are going is increasingly this is becoming automated, because it's still like, even, you know, for the years of progress at Instapage, we still didn't quite have the tools to make this like hyper scalable. And a good analogy is, and a lot of people don't know this, is Netflix actually, you know, not only recommends different videos to different people, we all know that's the case, but they actually change the thumbnails based on the user to take clips from different parts of the movie or the show based on what they think that is going to attract you. And they do this in an automated way to try to increase engagement and watch time, because it creates a stickier product for them. And hopefully a better watching experience for you. Yeah. But now with the tools that are available to us with these large language models that we're seeing with ChatGPT and whatnot, you can increasingly in an automated way look at the keyword, ask the language model based on this keyword, you know, what is the intent of the person? And based on that intent, generate me a, you know, what, why, how, who narrative for this landing page, and then change the content on the page. And that's kind of where it's in development now. And a big thing that I think drove the acquiring company of Instapage to buy it now, kind of at that turning point of where things are going.
Yeah.
And, you know, to put a pin on it, we had companies, and I still think are customers of Instapage, who had $50 million a year ad budgets, right? And so these increases of conversion mean, you know, millions of dollars in efficiency. And you know, our biggest customer, for example, HelloFresh, had something like $50 to $100 million a year in spend getting people to buy, you know, meal kit subscriptions. And you can think about that. A lot of people are searching various diets and different things. They're different geographic regions, so there might be different trends of different food in different areas. And they had a team of over 100 people building these landing pages, right? Which you know, we're building them, testing them, doing split testing and all this like manual work, but was still faster than having a team of engineers and whatnot. This is their marketing team.
Right.
But today, increasingly now, you can just feed a list of 1,000 keywords in and then generate these this context of, you know, what the intent is. And then based on the intent, you know, build this, you know, what we like to call like a what, why, how, who framework, which is the narrative of the page, which really is the sells to the customer. And, you know, you
the avatar of what they expect.
And you don't have to do, you know, you don't have to do any of that cognitive thinking. You don't have to be an expert copywriter. The machine, you know, is basing that context off of what it understands about all of the language, you know, and all of the information on the internet.
Well, if that works, I'm just running numbers in my head. And if I'm HelloFresh and I spend $100 million and I have a 3% conversion, I mean,
and you move that to
12%,
right?
I just 4x'd my money.
Yeah, 100%. Like, so
that's crazy.
At the end of the day, you know, people ask like, what was Instapage? Like, what do we sell? What did we sell? And does Instapage still sell? It's advertising conversion efficiency, right? It's an ROI on your advertising spend. So if you think about it from an investment standpoint, and you're an investor and you're going to put, you know, $10 million in an investment fund, and you're looking for a return of 8% annual, or trying to beat the S&P. Well, we think about ad spend the same way. So when our sales reps, you know, we're talking to companies, we're like, well, you're spending X amount of money. Even if you're spending $1 million a year, what's your return on that, right? Oh, I'm getting 3% conversions. Well, the math doesn't break out exactly like that, because your cost of goods sold might be different than someone else's. But overall, like, you know, if you could increase that to 12%, that's a substantial return, right? And so when we would quote people justifiably, you know, contracts starting at, you know, $50,000 to $100,000 a year for enterprise accounts, you know, of course, based on the volume of ad spend that they have, it was an easy to justify it, because it's a advertising return efficiency. It's not just a what's the cost of the monthly subscription, right?
Well, if you reverse it, they could potentially spend $25 million
right
to get this on ads. Result of spending.
Right.
So you're
spending a couple hundred thousand dollars
and spending $75,000 less.
Yeah, precisely.
$75 million.
Yeah. Which is a big part of where we went with Instapage and what it's focused on today is enterprise sales, right? And for us, you know, our bread and butter was selling to SMBs, people that have the same problem at a smaller scale, you know, and charging a, you know, a monthly or annual fee to access our software to build landing pages on their own. And like you said, you see the market now quite saturated with that, with, you know, the likes of ClickFunnels and other businesses. Which is funny that two of the landing page companies that originated both came from Boise, right? I don't.
Yeah,
I think maybe that says a little bit about the scrappiness of Idaho entrepreneurs, like trying to find efficiencies in growing businesses. But now, you know, focusing on businesses that, you know, spend tens of millions of dollars a year on advertising because it's their top channel for customer acquisition.
That's huge.
Right?
That's huge. Well, it's funny because as I'm listening to you talk about it, I get angry at Zillow or angry at Zillow about Zillow. So if you're a realtor, you spend all this money in dues and fees, you pay the MLS fees.
Yeah.
And so I work hard to get a listing or to acquire a client.
Right.
I put that information on the MLS and they did a terrible job acquiring new buyers.
Right.
You know, like they did a terrible job advertising.
Yeah.
Horrific. So in comes Zillow. All they do is make a way better landing page,
yep.
Way sexier page, way more intuitive, user-friendly, and they stole all of it.
Yep.
They stole all of our market share and then sell us the leads back to us. So I pay money to put my listings on the internet.
Your asset.
To the MLS. Zillow steals it. They actually, MLS sold the information to Zillow to make money.
Right.
Which I don't think we approved, but they did it anyways. And then Zillow's now selling us back. And I don't remember what the exact number is, but like last year, for example, they sold something like 5 times the amount of leads
that
were homes for sale.
Wow. Yeah.
So they're
a great business.
A killing because they know that realtors suck at converting.
Yeah.
They can sell the same lead 5 or 6, 7 times. One of us will eventually convert it. And it's our own information.
Yeah.
But it just highlights the huge issue of there's people that really need help converting.
Yeah.
And so it's really cool that you found a niche in the market,
you know,
and ran with it.
Platforms are obviously the best place because like the platforms themselves can start using AI and personalization to find buyers. So whether it's like a platform for homes like Zillow or a platform for movies like Netflix or a platform for products like Amazon, platforms are ultimately the best and they kind of control the personalization and the fine tuning of conversions, and they can tweak it based on their own profitability. We like to think about, like, you know, with Instapage, that it was helping personalize like the long tail of non-platform based sales predominantly. Like typically you're not going to run like a ad directly to an Amazon listing unless that Amazon product has at least enough of a average sales price to justify it. But for all the businesses who don't, whether they professional services, you know, big ticket price item real estate where you're trying to find a specific niche buyer, you know, information products, education products, you know, education is huge with landing pages because they're, you know, you're getting applicants for schools and universities, insurance companies. So finance is really big. And a lot of these services don't really have platforms. Like you don't really have a platform for like getting leads for schools that's all centralized in a singular place, but maybe that's a great business model to hop on next, right?
Yeah. I mean, you've got the time on your hands now.
There's a lot of ideas cooking here post acquisition, but.
Well, and if you feel comfortable, I'd love to take a break from the business and tell us about your exit because we hung out in July.
Yep.
And you were working a deal and you said earlier when we walked in here, it took a year longer.
Yeah.
There was bank issues,
and yeah,
not with you guys, but in the world, and specifically here in Silicon Valley. Tell us a little bit about your exit, because that's exciting. I love to see my friends win. And when we hung out in July, I was really happy for you. Still
win.
Thank you. But tell us a little bit about your exit. We know it took you years and years to build this thing up. You had investor money. But you just had a really exciting, cool, fun exit. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, definitely. So There is some things that I can't discuss because now it's the property of a different owner in terms of price and whatnot. But I can say that when we sold the company, just before we sold the company's annual run rate was just over $30 million. I still think the pastures were quite green with where AI is going and everything. So I think that, first of all, when you think about exits, a lot of people say, like, you know, don't exit in a tough market. This is obviously a really tough market. Sure. Multiples are down and whatnot. And I think that I would agree with that for the most part. But I would also agree with the fact, like, you know, exit when the time is right for you. And that's based on a number of factors, like what's going to be the return? Is it going to help you jumpstart your next thing? Where are you at, like, emotionally and psychologically? And for me, the company was, you know, 10 plus years old. I'd been investing this in a long time. As much passionate as I, you know, had for it, you know, I started to get interested in other areas of my professional career and wanted to also take a break from that startup grind, right? Instapage was, yeah, quality of life and just differentiation of experiences. And, you know, at the peak, Instapage, you know, again, just before we sold, there was some optimization prior to the sale for business efficiency. But the peak, we had almost 320 employees across, you know, like 7 countries and like 5 states. And, you know, I'm 36 and I started this, you know, 10 years ago. So it was had taken quite a big toll on my time and some of my relationships and my health. And so,
it's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. So there was a lot of reasons that kind of like ultimately ended up being why the timing made sense for myself. But also for the business. I think when you're presented with an opportunity, maybe the market isn't great, your multiple is slightly suppressed, but that buyer brings in an immediate valuation arbitrage, right? And so if the deal is, you know, partially cash, partially equity, well, if that business acquires your revenue, can you arbitrage into a higher multiple? Sure. Because that business now grew by whatever the revenue of the business they purchased was. So yeah. On paper, you can immediately make a return that surpasses the value of your own business. And then, of course, it's about rolling up into something even bigger. And with SaaS, I think these ecosystem plays where there's multiple SaaS products that you can sell into, cross-sell, upsell, downsell, to retain the customer creates a very healthy ecosystem that can keep growing and keep consuming new software businesses that can grow. And, you know, the plan for the acquiring company AirSlate is to eventually go public. And I think that my equity inside of their business has a great chance to go public faster than we could have IPO'd on our own.
Yeah.
But yeah, the sale happened 2 months ago now. You know, it's really caused a shift in my mentality of, you know, thinking about what I want to do next and
yeah.
Taking some time to think into some different avenues of life that I haven't had time for over the last 10 years.
No, that's awesome. And again, congrats.
Thank you.
Cool. You chose not to stay on. I'm sure they wanted you. Again, it was about quality of life. You mentioned that earlier.
Yeah.
Relationships. I mean, you have a wife and trying to have kids.
Yep.
Which is cool. You know, and I think back when I had my first daughter, I couldn't be home. I leave at 5 a.m. and come home in the afternoon to check on her, make sure she was good. And then I'd go back to work till 7, 8, 9 p.m. at night. My second boy, I moved my office to my house and I had him until 10 a.m. every day.
Right.
Come on. And being able to be in that position is going to be really cool for you.
Yeah.
You know, be able to, you know, say, hey, I don't feel like going to work today. That's fine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or actually don't have a job right now. That's really cool.
Yeah.
You know, you're unemployed at the moment, which is a really fun position. So I think that'll be exciting for you and Sasha. One thing that I wanted to kind of really, if I had a gong here, I'd ring it. You know, sometimes people don't think it's a good time to sell.
Yeah.
They say don't sell in a down market. Well, yes, the market's down, but maybe that was the best buyer for your business, like you
right.
said. And maybe it did give you the best opportunity to grow with them, you
know,
with this larger parent company and quality of life.
Yeah.
And we actually just sold 2 assets, 1 in Florida, 1 in Albuquerque. The market's not great. Rates are insane. We actually, Lyndon, my business partner's over here, everyone. How many buyers did we go through for Florida? It's like not 15 different LOIs. I think we're at LOI number 15.
Fun.
The market kept going.
Love that broker, man.
Yeah.
He didn't want to sell. I wanted to win. I wanted to give our investors a win. And I wanted to free up some of our time. I mean, quality of life.
Yeah.
Albuquerque was a no-brainer to sell. That we hated that bitch.
Yeah.
We don't live in
Albuquerque. Oh, okay.
That, I mean, heroin, that's the TikTok I had a 1.5 million views on.
Yeah.
Because I found heroin needles next to our apartment building.
Right. Not great for the sales prospect.
No, not great for the management prospect either, right?
Like, yeah.
We wanted to get rid of both of those to create wins for our investors. And we actually ended up, and I'm sure your ROI was way better than this,
but
we ended up averaging 20% per year average returns for our investors. That's cash flow plus equity combined.
Definitely beat the market. Yeah.
That crushes the market.
Yeah.
You know, could we have waited and made 25%?
Right.
Yeah. But Lyndon and I's quality of life.
Yeah.
And if we could lock in a good return, I said our quality of life is worth more than that.
Yeah. So when you think about quality of life, I think about it multifaceted, right?
Right.
And in one sense, when you're thinking about business, if you can sell an asset, especially if you can retain some type of ownership in it, and it can continue to grow with none of your time, now you can, you know, albeit at maybe a lower return to you, you can now free up your time to focus in another area of your business career.
It's called leverage.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So thinking about it from that standpoint, you know, maybe changes the perspective. But like you said, also, like, as an entrepreneur, as a business owner, you got to think about time as also a resource, right? It's not just money, it is time. And I think that a lot of people for a long time have focused on just like hustle culture, like you're just hustling. But you got to think about, like, what does it all mean? Like, if you love hustling and like that you wake up every single morning and like that's what you live for, and it's a game to you, then like, albeit, like, go for it, right?
Yeah.
But for most people, like, you got to take a step back sometimes and think about, like, what is my exit strategy? What is my goals? And if you're maximizing your time with your family, or your health or your hobbies, and you're having a, you know, great success in business, or you've had great success, like, don't get caught up in that just like hustle culture and like competition mindset of, I just got to, you know, compete for the dollars. It's about maximizing things. And ultimately, money is a means to an end for most people. And that means might be to grow something bigger and have a bigger impact. But it also might mean to, you know, to give yourself enough financial means to have great experiences, like, with, you know, with your family.
That's huge.
Yeah.
Yeah. And time is an asset. And I think, you know, as you're talking, two things popped in my head. One was Tommy Boy.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got this company that you're building and you're molding it, and you know, he's talking about the sale that he's trying to get. And if you over obsess over this company or this whatever you're building,
yeah,
you could take it down a road and you could grow it bigger and you could stay it into Instapage another 10 years and sell it for 2x or 3x what you just sold
right.
it, maybe. But you know, you've got this asset, which is time.
Yep.
And now you can grow it without putting more time into it.
Yeah.
And so I don't know why Tommy Boy popped in my head, but you know, you could obsess over this one little company, not that little, but
yeah.
Or you could move it along
right.
and go focus on another one, get it to the point where you don't have to run it. And now you've got multiple streams of income
yeah.
and multiple leverage on multiple companies. The second thing that popped in my head while you're talking is that's exactly what Warren Buffett does.
Yeah.
Does Warren Buffett know how to make chocolate? No, but he owns See's Candies.
Yeah.
Does he understand how to underwrite insurance policies? No, but he owns Geico.
Yeah.
Berkshire Hathaway does. Does he understand half the companies he's invested in? Probably not, but they all make him a lot of money.
Yeah.
And so that's exactly what you're talking about, is what Warren Buffett really teaches, which is buy a company or start a company.
Yeah.
Get it to the point where you can sell it, or get it to the point where you're not running it. Someone else is.
Yeah.
And it's still making you money. That's the idea behind what we've created at Multifamily Investment Club. Buy an asset, get it to the point where it's running, and you don't have to be in it every day.
Yeah.
It's called passive income.
And, you know, it's like the tried and true, you know, strategy of investing, but it just depends what you're after. Like, for all those entrepreneurs out there, I think that you can't really be super successful if you have no passion in whatever you're doing. Like if you are trying to be a real estate agent, but you just really don't like, you know, real estate or the homes that you're selling, like you're likely not going to do well, right? There has to be some genuine aspect of what you're doing. And
but got out of residential real estate.
Right.
didn't
love residential real estate, right? So I think that's important, but at the same time, like, what else do you love and value in your life? And I think that, you know, at some point operating a business, can start to be a diminishing return for your business prospects as well as your time asset, right? And finding that balance where, like, maybe you can step back from operating, you've reached an operating capacity where you've built something of value, and whether that means stepping back full time, trying to find a buyer for it, or, you know, hiring someone on and maybe losing some of that income, but trading it off for someone else to do it to free up that time, is one of the most important things I think most business operators or entrepreneurs should think about. And when is the right time for that? It's interesting that we tend to value time a lot less until we're getting older, and now time is the most valuable asset. Yep. And now you're trying to make up for maybe a decade or two loss and trying to spend lavishly or do the craziest experiences you can do, because you're making up for lost time. So now it's like quality of experiences.
Right.
But for me, you know, and I think more people should think in this way, is how can you have good experiences as early as you can in your professional career, so you don't look back and wish that you didn't devalue one of the most important assets that we all have de facto. But of course, if you don't have any resources, or your business is struggling, and you haven't reached any type of financial freedom where you can have your investments work for you, it's probably not the right time to try to deviate and put it purely in time, because that time might not be fulfilling to you because you just don't have the resources to do with that time of, you know, with what you would do if you had more resources.
Sure. And, right? And health goes downhill also, yeah, as you get older. And I think what you just said really is my parenting strategy that I have currently.
Yeah.
So you'll be a parent soon.
I'm glad we could cover parenting even in our conversation,
yeah,
today.
I do actually.
Yeah.
If you ask Lyndon, he's listened to many of my interviews. I cover every single one.
Awesome.
Because a lot of these entrepreneurs are really good parents.
Yeah.
Because they understand what you just said. You can't focus on this end goal and miss the journey.
Yeah.
That's a huge, huge mistake. And one of our investors and friends, a couple of years ago, he's like, "Man, Sam, you're a really good dad." He's like, "I never took my kids camping once."
You heard it from him.
Yeah. He's like, I never took my kids camping once.
Yeah.
I didn't take them on vacations. I worked hard and I taught them about money.
Yeah.
I never took them on vacations because I was working. And he's like, "I really regret that. Now they're gone. Now they're in college."
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, and on the reverse side, one of our investors and friends, Hal Swayze, he's a realtor in San Luis Obispo. 10 years ago, I heard him tell a story about how his kids were in middle school and he took a year off.
Yeah.
Literally shut down his business, took a year off, took them out of middle school. They were in seventh and eighth grade and they toured the world.
Wow.
A year. And I went,
yeah, good for them.
Crap. That's what I have to do.
Yeah.
With my kids.
I mean, good for both of them. Good for the parents. Good, yeah, for the kids. I mean,
and he's like, what did they miss? Seventh and, yeah, eighth grade. They learned nothing. We just put them in the next year,
yeah,
and acted like they didn't miss a year of school and they did fine.
I think these types of things, like at least for me, and it sounds like for you and others and probably many of the listeners, like a motivating factor is to like get to a point where you can do something like that.
Yeah.
Right. But like, make sure that, like, you know, along the way, you're not just, you know, filling your lack of time with like possessions, for example, like,
love that,
you know, like you're like, oh well, I don't have time, but I can buy this this car or whatever it be, and because you've chosen to spend your money on that thing, well now you definitely don't have as much time, right? So now
you got to work to pay off the car.
Exactly.
You know, I put a post up recently that said if you're not worth 20 million,
yeah,
you should not be buying a supercar,
right?
And when Tyler bought his McLaren is a coincidence. He got a little frustrated.
Yeah.
He thought I was doing it at him, but I said, you should never pay for an asset with cash,
or
pay for a liability with cash.
Right.
And he's like, did you do that for me? I was like, no,
yeah.
I mean, Tyler's, he's doing fine.
Yeah.
It's for my investors who,
right,
who they're literally deciding, do I invest in my future?
Yeah.
Or do I pay cash for a supercar?
Yeah.
And I'm like, how do you even do that math? Like,
right.
You're not in a position, Tyler was, you're not in a position to go pay cash for a supercar. You should never do that.
Yeah.
You're worth $20 million. You don't have passive income coming in. And
well, it's even at that point, like most people buying that asset, like you can pay for it in cash, but if you reach a certain level of financial success, then your assets themselves can be collateralized. And if you have a big enough margin, because your success has reached that level, that you know, you should never, you know, default on your, you know, liabilities. And of course, you have to be careful with that, as we've seen with over leveraged businesses or over leveraged people. But I think that, again, like your money should work for you, and you got to be thinking about that from day one. Like if you're setting out to build something or you're working hard when you wake up, like wake up every day with, you know, a foundation of like, what am I working towards? How can I get to a point where my money is working for me? Whether that be my money's working for me to hire more people to do a certain thing, to grow, you know, build something even bigger, or it's working for me and my interest on my, you know, my assets are paying for my children's school or whatever it be, right? And, but again, along the way, that's a decision you have to be thinking about as a goal and a foundation to your, you know, daily endeavors in your professional career. It's not something that you just do at the finish line. Oh, once I get to a certain exit or a certain sale, then I can do this. Like it should be rooted in, at least in my opinion, into the fabric of like what's motivating you to reach a certain level of success.
Well, some people will say, you know, I don't make enough to invest.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, no, for at least for me, even a very, very early age, I'm putting away 30%.
Yep.
And I'm not great with my money. It's funny, you know, I know myself.
Yeah.
If I have money in the bank, I figure out how to spend it.
Right.
And I figure out how to spend it before I have it in the bank. What I did that was very, very smart and good is I said, okay, every check, you know, it's 30% going towards whatever investment's next.
Yeah.
And I would put stuff under contract, or I would put in accountabilities. I'd put stuff on my wall, on my dream board. I'm going to buy this next condo or townhome or duplex.
Yeah.
And I was only making 100, 150, 200,000 a year as a realtor. And I was spending 30, 40% of that on investment properties.
Yes.
Well, and that way that money was gone and I couldn't spend
it. And that's the same thing about like, if you're building a business, it's like, say, you know, not a real estate business, you know, in my case, it was a software company. That's the same way that we thought about it every day when we're building it, especially in the days when we were bootstrapping, is like, how much of our profit margin can we roll back into the company?
I was gonna ask you that question.
Right. And that question should go as long as you can, like, you know, minimize profit and rolling it back into hiring better people, paying your people more that you do have to retain them, or buying a new, you know, service that's going to let you go into a, you know, new market or make someone more efficient. Like every single day, like in the business side, is about reinvesting the profits that we would have had into further growth.
So how much did you guys, did you have a percentage, or did you just kind of figure out, okay, here's the direction we want to go with the company. We made X and we're going to reinvest this amount in. I mean, I just had a rule of thumb. I wanted at least 30% of what I made back into investments.
So
I don't know if that's similar to you or.
Yeah. I mean, well, it depends on the profitability of that business, right? For us, like we invested like 100% of what we would have, you know, had in profit to distribute to shareholders, and then some, right? Because we were in a position where we realized that raising money, you know, was going to be a better investment to grow, given that we could really fine tune our unit economics. And one of the beautiful things about software or real estate is if you're taking the time to really look at your financial modeling, is things shouldn't move too crazily and volatilely. If you're smart with the way you're pursuing things. And for us with software as a service, after enough time, we could start to predict, you know, how much does it cost to acquire a customer? How big do we think this market is? How fast is that market growing? You know, what's the competition? What's the, you know, the profit margins? What's the payback period on the customer we did acquire? And if we saw that there was still market to grow into and the math still, you know, kept playing out and the average customer acquisition costs, you know, stayed pretty constant, and it was, say, you know, 5-6 months of payback, then we can anticipate our future revenue. So at that point, it made it easy for us to decide, hey, we should pursue some investment capital, whether that be equity or debt. Debt was, of course, more appealing when interest rates were very low.
Sure.
You know, you could take on debt instead of equity and avoid dilution, and then grow into that and, you know, pay it back through future equity rounds or through profitability. But the point there is that even when you're growing a business, whether it be real estate or software, is in your business, you're constantly reinvesting capital, reinvesting things. And so in your personal life, as you're, you know, having success with your, you know, professional career, how are you reinvesting that? And I think that back to our conversation earlier on, you know, time being money, if you're reinvesting some of that success along the way in creating a nest egg that can continue to grow with no effort, you know, passive, you know, index funds or real estate, then eventually you'll get to a point where, you know, you can look at it and say, hey, you know, my lifestyle is being paid for all these investments that I've made over the past, you know, 5 to 20 years or whatever.
Right.
But you can't think about it later. You have to start thinking about it day one.
Which is hard because everyone wants the iPhone 15.
Yeah.
Everyone wants to wear really nice expensive right. clothing and they want to drive the nice cars. And, you know, I lived in flips. I lived yeah. in crappy, gross houses for 10 years.
Yeah.
Every time we'd get the house really nice, you know, within a year, and then we'd move out of it. As soon as it looked good, we'd move out and sell it or rent it out
yeah.
and do another crappy one. There's a lot of people that don't want to make those sacrifices. They want yeah. the instant gratification. They want the lifestyle now rather than having it later. The one thing that I did want to ask you that I think I know the answer to, because I know you personally, I know Tyler, I know your dad, I know your mom, all really great people.
Yeah.
Tell me about reinvesting in yourself as far as education and personal growth, though,
yeah.
because that's something that as an entrepreneur, you have to do it. And in SaaS and tech, in the tech world, you have to do that way more because
yeah.
it's changing and evolving. Real estate doesn't change. That's actually why I love it.
Yeah.
Because
keeps it simple.
I'm nerdy. I'm boring. And
yeah.
I'm like, I want to know exactly what to do. And I want to be able to predict the next 20 years.
Yeah.
And multifamily real estate hasn't changed in 2000.
Like, yeah.
Literally, people come in rent, they pay rent. And, you know, in the
yeah.
last 200 years, it's been pretty predictable.
That's yeah.
The last 50 years, pretty predictable. It doesn't change.
Yeah.
SaaS and tech, that's all very different. So I'm guessing you had to spend a lot of your time, money, and effort attending conferences
yeah.
and building your brain and building yourself, your mentality, the way you attack business. So tell
yeah.
me a little bit about reinvesting in yourself as the CEO and
yeah.
founder of the company and what that took and how it paid off.
Yeah, that's a great question. And you know, I love the question because I'm kind of an information, like education junkie, right? If I have any addiction, it's probably like information consumption. Yeah.
Like almost identical that way. You guys know, I'm like, when did you learn that?
Yeah.
Like where you're just reading all the time or what's going
yeah,
on?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And, you know, but back to your point, I think that even with real estate, I think that the market still changes. I mean, the way the consumer finds the product is changing. So, you know, the modality of information changes. So like you're doing this podcast, for example. So I think that that doesn't matter what industry you're in. Like there's always going to be things to learn, all these new people to talk to. So it just depends on the varying degrees of like how much something's changing. And for software, it does change quite a ton. So one of the things that I like to do is as like the founder, as the former CEO, is the more things I can outsource, the more people I can hire to do certain things, the more time I have to spend learning, right? Because if anything, like, as a CEO, you're like the chief learning officer, right? Like if everyone else is like doing operations, like who's taking the time to go like rampantly learn about where the market's going? And, you know, talking to investors, and if you go into the investor and all you can talk about is operations of the day-to-day business and you can't talk about the market because you've been over here in the day-to-day, you're missing the forest for the trees, right? Because the market moves, right? And in our case, it's whether it's competitors or new platforms like mobile comes out, how does that change things? And yeah. AI is coming out. Like, and if you miss these trends, you're missing massive value opportunities. And even more so in technology, because you should have been on that technology 2 years ago or 6 months ago and incorporating it in, because by the time everyone's using it, the value arbitrage is already diminished because now it's commoditized.
And now they're moving on to something else.
And now you're moving on to something else.
Have you read the book, Great by Choice?
I haven't, but I've heard good things.
Definitely read it. That's kind of what helped me think of this question. The CEOs, I mean, they're chief learning officer.
Yeah.
It talks about Intel and memory cards and processors.
Yeah.
and who their competition was. And over the last 20, 25 years, you know, what really caused them, they would jump on the trends quicker.
Yeah.
And they would jump on the trend 6 months faster than the competition.
Yeah.
Because that's what they knew they had to do to keep an edge on the market.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that one of the things you can do, again, thinking about all of the, you know, core subjects that we're covering, like, you know, maximizing time as an asset and, you know, reinvesting is optimizing time. And I think platforms like this, like a podcast, or, you know, you have YouTube or you have audiobooks, I like to multitask as much as possible. And so if, you know, we have limited time, right? And we have, especially entrepreneurs, like there's so much we want to do and accomplish. Whether it be with our personal time or it be in our careers, there's just so much to want to accomplish that the more you can maximize fitting in the necessity of learning and staying on top of things into other areas of your life, the better. And so I think for me, like I rarely read a physical book unless like I'm on a flight, right? And then it's kind of a nice enjoyment. Or if I really want to relax, you know, fall asleep or whatever, like sit down, find a, you know, some time to read. But these days, like I will, you know, do the Peloton and in with the music off and like watch a bunch of YouTube updates on a breakdown of a certain market or an investment strategy. Or I will, right. I mean, it's absolutely
learn anything you want.
Anything. Yeah. Yeah. And, or if it's walking the dog, I'm listening to an audiobook, right? Or, you know, a lot of people,
sorry, I'm going to pause you. Talk about maximizing time. How fast do you listen to the audiobook? Cause I'm on 1.25.
I do 1.4. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't listen that fast. So
it depends what I'm doing as well. If I'm doing something like, lifting weights, I'll slow it down because I realize that like, there's more for me to think about like, okay, what set am I going to do next? Or, you know, if I'm counting reps or something,
driving.
If I'm just driving or walking a dog, then like, I mean, it's really passive. Right. And for me, it's 1.4.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm
yeah.
1.25. And for me, that's, you can get through a lot of books.
Absolutely. I do the same thing with YouTube, for example. Like there's a reason why I think they have the speed setting. And of course it can become an addictive thing too. Like I said, if I have any addiction, it's to information and learning. So you have to figure out like, do I need to really watch the eighth video on the same subject? I think like I've taken away from, you know, it, what I need to get from this subject and maybe I should go cook dinner or something. But
really quick on that though,
yeah.
I think that's a Christy and Troy thing. Did they embed that like need for learning in you? Was that come natural? Cause you and Tyler have the same.
Yeah.
For our listeners. I grew up with Tyson and his older brother. Tyler's a year older than me, right? So we went to high school together. But you both turned out very similar as far as acquiring new information constantly.
Yeah.
Literally, I get half my updates from Tyler and he's telling me all this new stuff that's going on and things. You know?
Yeah.
So you guys are always acquiring knowledge. And I'm wondering, Christy, Troy, that's your mom and dad.
Yep.
Did that come from them or is that just kind of in your guys' DNA?
Yeah. I mean, I think everything's a little bit of nurture and nature, right?
Yeah.
It's a good point. I think that, you know, the nurture side, yes, I think that one thing, you know, my parents were very young and they were learning themselves. And so there's not a lot of time they could spend on, they just threw us out there and figure it out, right? So I think forming the ability to problem solve and think and collect information from a very early age on the nurture side, like definitely helped. Some days, you know, it's more frustrating than others. Like, hey, I want to be a kid more, but ultimately, you know, I think worked out to our benefit. And then from a nature side, I mean, I have ADHD myself, and I like to think about ADHD as a double-edged sword. A lot of, you know, famous entrepreneurs have ADHD, whether it be Bill Gates or Richard Branson. And so naturally my brain wants to acquire a lot of information in a lot of different areas and think about things holistically, which can also be a struggle though, because when it comes to starting and finishing something and working hard and having perseverance, it can make that challenging. But for me personally, because that's a nature thing, I found that learning something, then delegating it and then checking in, you know, on that delegation to see if it's going well and the results are speaking for themselves, like lets me deviate into some other area. But it's a great question. I don't, to what degree
finalize the task for you, you get it started.
Right.
ADHD.
Exactly.
You solved a problem, which is, hey, I don't always finish what I start. Let me delegate.
That's
perfect.
You know, and on that regard, I think one of the things that I wanted to mention about if I can attribute something to my success with Instapage is, really like two big standout things. One is on this subject is choosing what to prioritize, right? And this can be something that creates analysis paralysis for anyone, because prioritization is both like an art and a science. And especially if you have ADHD like I do, or just have distraction like we all do because of the amount of information coming to us, that prioritization can be very, very challenging. And so I tried to put as much effort as I could, and I still do this in my day-to-day life, trying to figure out what is my top priority and why, and what informed that, and what's like a lower priority and what's the least priority. And like rampantly trying to constantly refine and do that, because you can end up...
The opposite. Yeah. It's called creative avoidance. There's people that maybe the thing that you need to do is also the most difficult.
Yeah.
So they get all this other stuff done because it's easy.
Yep. Absolutely.
You know, right. I
avoiding the biggest ticket item thing.
I have a handyman that comes over a couple times a week.
Yeah.
I've been remodeling the house and building a pergola, and he's like, hey, can I do this?
Yeah.
No, I need you to go do like what is on your list. I put it at the top because that's the most important.
Yeah.
It's also the thing you didn't want to do.
Yeah.
Because it was hard. It was cold outside and you had to get up on the roof. And it's like, and so it's funny because he just kept all day doing all the other stuff. I'm like, buddy,
it's
at the top of your
list. It's not going away.
It's the most important thing.
Yeah.
Go get it done.
Yeah.
But people do that. Salespeople do that. Instead of making the sales calls, we get all the busy paperwork done.
Yep.
We get all the other stuff done, all the emails answered. But we really got to go make those sales calls.
Yeah.
And that's actually a common thread with entrepreneurs that are successful. They just knock out the important or hardest things because you have the discipline and also you're connecting the dots. If I'm going to be a successful business owner, I actually have to do those things. I got to stop avoiding them. So I like that you brought that up.
Yeah, absolutely. And you got to say no to a lot of stuff too, you know, which some days is easier than others, but you're going to miss out on a lot of opportunities. And you have to accept that, but you know, It's like wanting to get really fit and having to say no to your friends, like, you know, weekend barbecue, or, you know, or maybe you do go, but you're not drinking or whatever.
I
maybe
said no to the donuts today.
There you go. See? So you got to, the reality in life and business is you're going to have to say no a lot to a lot of things that would have brought joy or pleasure, but you have to remember that you're saying no for a reason, because it's creating something else that's better. And that brings me to the second thing I would attribute my success to, which is perseverance, right? If you're persevering towards something, you have a goal in mind, you got to remind yourself of that every day and stick to it, because way too much of what I see today, you know, in this false sense of that, like you're going to get rich quick or you're going to have some success overnight. And for those people who have achieved that, like, great. It's not the norm. It's not the case for 99% of people. Even the best investors in the world, like, you know, best venture capitalists, like 9 out of 10 of their startups are going to fail. One's going to succeed, right? And so like persevering though, and you know, Steve Jobs said it himself, that he's convinced that the main thing that differentiates someone who's successful from those who aren't is pure perseverance. Now you can't again persevere in a way that's like, just futile, right? Where you're just persevering and just pure perseverance is going to create and make you a pro athlete or something.
Right.
But you should persevere enough within the reality of whatever you're persevering towards. And you need to think about, is this actually worth my time? But I talked to a lot of people, and like, look, if you spend the next 3 to 5 years and you're just trying to make the best podcast you could possibly make, or you're doing real estate and you wake up every single day and you're focused on that, you're going to be 9 out of 10 people who give up. Right. And this is going to be true for if you want to be the best dad, or you want to be a professional athlete, or, you know, you have a great hobby you want to get the best at. And it's definitely true in business. But again, as you're persevering, as you're working harder than most people and just waking up every day and showing up, you know, don't forget to make sure you're not doing it in a futile way that takes away from your important asset of time.
Right.
Right. There is, you need to, going back to the prioritization, prioritize within that realm as well. Is this worth my investment? If it is, keep at it.
All right. So we're running out of time here. This has been awesome.
Yep.
Hearing about your journey. Perseverance. I think that, you know, I always like to pull out golden nuggets for our listeners and make sure that they hear what you just said. And that was a huge golden nugget. People quit when it gets hard. And, you know, as a salesperson, as a business owner myself,
We've had our backs against the wall many times and I just won't quit.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really the people that make it happen. And that was actually my first broker's, his whole slogan. He said, "Hey, we will make you successful."
Yeah.
Despite yourself. And, you know, that says a lot when you will drag people with you, you drag your partners, your clients, and you'll just keep pushing and pushing. You don't have to be the best.
Yeah.
You don't have to have the best product. If you keep pushing to innovate and to be better and better and better and to get the job done, you will be successful.
Absolutely. And if anything, I think if there's a something you can pass to your employees or to your children or whatnot, I think, you know, hard work and perseverance is something that you should strive to implement, right? And in the form of a business, you know, that's leading by example, right? Like, again, don't just work hard for working hard's sake, but go after your top priority item and follow through and finish it, right? If you were, you know, I think about this when I'm working out, like, this is hard, but yeah, it's hard, like, keep at it. Like, I have a goal in mind, and for me, you know, I'm an alpinist, so I like to climb mountains. So I think there's a theme here of just, like, doing hard things and persevering. But you will get to the top of the mountain, right? You will be able to hit your, you know, personal fitness goals. You will be able to get to a point where you've made the right connections. You've networked enough. You've grown your business. You've gotten to a point of financial freedom. Right. But again, don't do it so it's detrimental to your life along the way. But like, perseverance shouldn't be that, right? If you're working,
you're at the right thing.
Exactly. And if you're being smart with your time and resources, it shouldn't be futile. It shouldn't be a waste of your time. It shouldn't make you sacrifice everything. You know, you're not, don't wake up at 5 a.m. every day and go to sleep at midnight. Like, we're not, I'm not saying that. Don't burn yourself out, but persevere, right?
The other nugget I want to pull out really quick is exit at the right time.
Yeah.
We're here talking about an exit. You know, you exited a company, which is exciting as hell. And there's people maybe that would say, well, you know, maybe Tyson should have held on for another few years.
Yeah.
Gotten a bigger exit.
Yeah.
But it was the right time for you. And it was a good time to exit. You got a great payout.
Yeah.
Congrats. That's awesome.
Thank you.
You just exited a couple properties and they were great payouts.
Yeah.
And, you know, a bird in the hand is what my investor, I was telling my investor, Rand, he's older. He's exited three companies. You know, worth a ton of money. And he's like, "Sam, if the numbers look good, who cares?
Yeah.
Maybe you could get a little bit more later in a year or two, but a bird in the hands worth two in the bush. Exit. Let's go. This is great."
Yeah. And if you're thinking about it purely from a financial standpoint, well, don't forget that what can you do with with more time on your hand to maybe maximize whatever you got from that exit, right?
Two really good nuggets. I'm glad we pointed out. We were running out of time. So persevere, exit at the right time, and
prioritize.
Give yourself freedom to pivot and do other things.
Yeah.
What's a good book you can recommend to our listeners and someone who's had a big effect in your life as far as a mentor or maybe someone you looked up to?
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite books of all time, and this isn't a business book. This isn't a, you know, gonna, you know, improve your perseverance book, but this is like an optimism book. It also, for me, like, given the industry that I'm in, is very inspirational. This book is called Abundance: The Future is Better Than You Think. And it's really about how humans over time have continued to innovate and create things that have made life better. And if you stop listening to the daily news or looking at whatever the current event is, and you look at the bigger picture, like, life is getting better for humans on this planet at a increasing rate, whether it's like child mortality or, you know, life expectancies or, you know, literacy rates. Like, if you look at the macro, like, life is getting better. And like, for me, it was like, well, how am I going to be part of that? And how am I going to maximize my time so I can enjoy this wondrous time that we live in that, of course, has its challenges, has its own issues, but on a historical context, like, we live in a great time and a time that gives us opportunity to pursue, you know, whatever it is that we're putting our passions towards or experience things that most other humans would never get a chance to do. And so that book really gave me a lot of inspiration. It also gave me inspiration as an entrepreneur to be part of that change that would improve our employees' lives, or just to be part of that, the capabilities that we have now as an individual entrepreneur coming from Idaho, right?
Yeah. Abundance is huge. Having an abundance mindset. I stay way away from partners, clients, investors who have a scarcity mindset.
Yeah.
And so I love that you said that, because that is so telling of how you look at life and how you treat people in life, how you treat your business, and if you're going to be successful.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mindset. mentor or someone you look up to or someone that made a difference in your business?
Yeah. Well, I would like to, you know, say obviously my father, like, led by example, worked really hard, and is someone that taught me a lot of that nurture lessons. But I would say from a purely business standpoint, I would say probably Mark Benioff at Salesforce, not only because it's relevant to the industry that Instapage is within, which is software as a service, but also from someone who I think has continued to show perseverance, prioritization, and leadership, and someone who seems to maximize the time with what they have, right? They're able to delegate and bring in amazing employees that have continued to grow, you know, shareholder value and this company that he's founded. But also he spends a lot of his time on philanthropy and talking about other areas of his life that he's focused on. And I think any great entrepreneur should branch out and use their skills or their lessons to teach others and to lead by example in many, many other ways. And I think he's obviously been a great example to see his success and to see what he continues to contribute to.
Absolutely. That's awesome. Well, we're excited to see, you know, after you take this hiatus, what you do next, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Whether it's SaaS, whether it's philanthropy.
Maybe I'll start a podcast.
Start a podcast. You should, honestly. You know, maybe you're mentoring new startups through the podcast. You take, I mean, that would be cool. So there's lots of doors open for you at this point. So excited. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Yeah. Likewise.
Good. Congrats again. This has been fun.
I'm excited we could do it. And we started in Idaho and now we're here.
Yeah.
Thanks, man. All right. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you for listening to the Get Leveraged podcast with Sam Newell. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And share this episode with the person who needs to hear it most. Tune in next week for another incredible conversation. We'll see you there.